Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like a home wrecker.
Oh no, why is that?
Because I'm here to, you know, distort and break up traditional ideas of femininity and, and that is what today's guest is also doing, which I love. And
you are a home wrecker. I've heard people describe you as a home wrecker in Margate.
The rumours are going around, aren't they? Yeah. Today's guest is an amazing artist, originally from Sweden, but now based in Berlin. And this idea of home wrecking is the central title of their new London exhibition, which runs until the end of December. And I mentioned ideas of femininity and kind of maybe like hypersexualized and kind of this idea of women within popular culture, particularly in advertisements for domestic items like laundry detergent, sofas, even prams. And prams have actually become a theme in their work. They're also, as well as being an incredible, powerful artist and sculptor, they have also collaborated a lot in different mediums and across different platforms, even with like Balenciaga and all kinds of kind of different collaborations. And right now they're collaborating with The Collector and the gallery, The Perimeter, which is a private collection based in London, but they're now staging incredible exhibitions. You yourself even curated one, didn't you, Russ?
I did. It was mine and Alex Petalis. It was works from our collections which reflected each other, and it was about like a reflection of you was the title of the exhibition, and it was just bringing in pieces that really felt like they were complementing each other, because we've been individual collectors but yet we've had the same sort of ideas around acquiring work. So that was a really fascinating exhibition, and the space is incredible on Brownlow Muse in Brownlow Muse in Clerkenwell in London.
And I really love Alex, because Alex alongside buying artists' work is actually really committing himself to the presentation of new ideas. And I think this exhibition is so powerful, and you and I both loved it so much that we wanted to meet today's guest. So we are very excited to welcome to Talk Art, all the way from Berlin, Anna Udenberg. Hi, Anna.
Hello. Hi.
How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm good.
So you're in Berlin in an area called Kreuzberg, is that correct?
Actually, I'm a Mitte, in Mitte girl. Yeah. So it's sort of central Berlin. But my studio is in Kreuzberg, so yeah, that's correct.
So for Berlin, is Kreuzberg or Mitte, these are hubs for artists to have spaces?
I think typically Kreuzberg would probably be more or used to be the where artists would be located, but nowadays people are sort of moving more and more to the outskirts of the city. It's getting kind of difficult to find studio spaces.
And why Berlin? So you were born in Stockholm in Sweden. How did you end up in Berlin, and why was that a place that you sort of set up?
I think it just sort of happened this way. I went to art school in Frankfurt, Stadelschule, and but then I graduated in Stockholm, and I sort of realized that Stockholm felt a bit too small, or I needed to sort of just move on. And Berlin was sort of the place where I knew people there, and it was still relatively easy to, you know, start something new, whilst other cities were just, and where I was at the time, way too, you know, expensive and difficult. So it was a very practical decision. But yeah, I'm happy about it because Berlin still just has this sort of connection to elsewhere in the world. So what you do in Berlin doesn't necessarily stay there, which I think is a really good thing.
I always felt like Berlin had a really strong aesthetic as well. And I feel like with the kind of work you're making, it almost kind of makes sense that you're making it in Berlin somehow, because there's a real like urban aesthetic, but also a kind of hard-edged, I don't know how to describe it. It's almost like a kind of nonchalant cool thing. It's like, and I don't mean that as a negative. I mean it as a really great thing. It's like a language of its own. And there's something really specific about your approach to sort of sculpture and, I don't know, making work that, like, has Berlin actually, like, inspired that? Because I've always felt like there's so much kind of blank, like, empty spaces in Berlin. You can, like, walk down streets and it's empty, but then when you get inside buildings, it's full of people and there's loads of people there doing stuff. But there is this kind of, like, desolate atmosphere at times.
That's so true.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think that, for me, that it allows a lot of headspace, and the city's not so demanding per se. Like, you can really sort of get in a really good focus here, and then if you want to meet with people and you know, there are always things happening, but it's not that it's sort of it's never in your face or anything like that. But I do probably, I'm not sure about I mean, I'm sure depending on where I am, I sort of source the material that's in my immediate surrounding. So I remember just when I moved to Berlin, I was sort of, I spent a lot of time in Sonnenallee and these places where, like Neukölln, where there are a lot of small shops that would sell these sort of knockoff handbags or just pile up, you know, kind of, I guess, yeah, it's kind of cheap suitcases. And so I would really, you know, sort of incorporate all that into my work one way or another. So maybe in that sense, it has had this sort of immediate, it's been reflected sort of in this immediate way in my work.
Well, I feel like with Berlin as well is that you don't know where the party is as a tourist, but yet as soon as you get told or you get in with people, then suddenly this door opens, and as Rob was saying, then you're in this warehouse full of people and you're like, where have you all been? And I feel like with your work, it's like, I feel like you're this kind of, you're incredibly successful, but you're still this kind of secret. And then when you discover your work and you walk into an exhibition, it's literally like, what the fuck is this? This is like next level. And this has all been going on. And I've not really seen it. It has this real, it is so striking, your practice and the sculptures and what you are doing when it comes to installation, that it's like unlike anything I've ever seen, and it is changing the dial.
Yeah, Russ, you know what? I said to someone the other day, it's like another world. And I feel like you enter this world
fantasy,
and then you get sucked into it. It's almost like an alternate reality. I love it so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I don't know. Really, I think, I mean, of course, I'm the center of my own universe. So for me, it's been here all this time, you know.
Yeah, so it's hard
to, yeah.
I love this story then. I want to go back and this story I read about you, and you are the center of it. And it did used to come from you, but I think I've read now that you're trying to make the art outside of yourself rather than you being integral to it. But when you were younger at school, you used to dress in clothes that were ultra feminine, and you told people that you were quite promiscuous. I hope this isn't triggering, okay, to bring up, but there was, for many years, your teachers, I think you said, and other students called you a slut. But instead of being shy about it, you sort of embraced this persona and became even more kind of ultra feminine. And it's something that you were able to sort of... Do you know what it makes me think of? It makes me think of Dolly Parton tells this story about how it was she dresses the way she dresses because she's inspired by this woman who was like told that she was really cheap. And she has this phrase, like, it costs a lot of money to look this cheap. But everyone else was kind of looking at this woman, seeing her as trash. But for Dolly Parton, she was her hero. And I feel like you were sort of that sort of energy you were embracing as an adolescent and really giving yourself agency for whatever this persona was. Can we talk about that? Because that, I find that so inspiring.
Sure. Like, I mean, I was, this was exactly, yeah, really when I was so, from my early teenagers. I don't know. I guess I just sort of encountered the world of I guess grown-ups, mostly a lot of teachers, and were sort of outraged by the way I was dressing, which for me wasn't really that, you know, big of a deal. Like I thought, you know, Spice Girls was, I was kind of a baby Spice into, let's say, Lil' Kim Hardcore album was my favorite at the time.
Love that.
Yeah, right? So, and it's, for me, that was sort of really something that I just loved full-heartedly, but then gradually understanding how, you know, getting these sort of, I guess, slut-shamed on a daily basis for years, literally, in school, both from, teachers, but even...
It's mad that teachers were saying like, it.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, how can you call, like, a 13-year-old girl a slut? Like, it's really not... it's kind of insane. But so that, obviously, back then, I did not know anything about feminism. I did not have any of that... you know, I didn't have that vocabulary or any of that knowledge. But later on, I sort of understood that this is, I think Dolly Parton is a really good example, because it is, she sort of embraces something that I find also, I mean, it's both obviously problematic in a sense that, you know, I'm not, it's like, I think the way I would approach my work is that I don't have like any clear answers. It's not that I'm just like going to go out on the, you know, celebrating a slut parade or anything like that. But I do think that there is something that comes out of a lived experience of, you know, growing up as a female / femme identifying person, and how the world sort of treats you, and then bounce it back onto that very same attitude. I don't know. It's really, instead of toning it down, just sort of turning it up instead. Like, just, yeah.
But I mean, that's like you're talking about the Spice Girls, Emma Bunton, Baby Spice and Little Kim. Well, that's exactly what they did. Everybody was saying, tone it down, don't do that. And they just go the opposite direction and push it. You know, there's been so many icons like Madonna, for example, in history, who has just been like, middle finger up. Absolutely not. I'm going to make you even more shocked.
But even recently, like Taylor Swift, like reissued her album because she's re-recording everything, and she's released a song called Slut, which wasn't on the original album, I think because the record label didn't want it on there. But it was her response to everyone calling her a slut because, you know, she might have gone on dates with however many guys, whatever, over a period of a year, whatever. You know, no one even knows what happens in her life, but she was getting slut-shamed by fans and by, like, the public generally, like trolls. And I love the fact she wrote a song about it. I was like, go Taylor, it made me love her even more.
The agency of that, and then finding, yeah, you know, as artists, how exciting it is that you can channel that into a practice. And what we see when we come to you is these incredibly empowering female forms that are not, you know, on first glance, you could feel like there was some sort of, narrative, and I mean, a lot of people are projecting narratives, that there's a narrative of, are they victims? Are they victims of something? But not, they have absolute agency in the way that, you know, like a lap dancer or a pole dancer, for example, as society, we project onto them that poor them, they've ended up there because, you know, life has got taken a wrong path. But actually, the reality is that that's their own choice. Many of them, they're sex positive. That's what they want to do. And
they're making a living.
Exactly. And these characters that exist in your worlds have total agency, and they're giving a permission to stare, which I'm obsessed with. And they are aware you're there, but they're just like getting on with their lives.
I think it's something also happens when you perform something, you know, if slightly wrong, meaning slightly too much, or, you know, if, like, I did this show back in 2011 as my graduation show was about the idea of an it girl, and I invited five women that were girls that I was interviewing a number, maybe 50 people, about their ideas of an it girl, and ended up working with five who were sort of performing their notion of what an it girl is for them at the opening in the exhibition. So the whole setup was sort of a PR event for it. And when I sort of did some research about where this idea come from, and when was it even coined, it dated back to somewhere time in the 20s in Hollywood. And it's all about being effortlessly cool and sexy. And for me, I think it's interesting, this idea that it has to be effortless, because the moment you start seeing that there's some sort of work behind this, you know, character, this performance, it starts to sort of fall apart, or people think that it's fake, or it's, you know, you can sort of start tracing back if you're what sort of cultural background or so you have. And so for me, I think there is something happening when the effort becomes visible, and when there's also the when it's no longer, I guess, effortless, and when we start to see, you know, that's when it's this idea of whatever this it is starts to become apparent, that it is sort of just, it's a very sort of artificial idea to begin with. And there is some agency in that, I'd say, to sort of misperform something, or sort of, because while doing so, you sort of break out of the norm that is supposed to be sort of seamless and pleasing, or, you know, whatever.
So are your characters effortless, or are they making an effort to the point where we're seeing the work?
I think they're working pretty hard, actually. I think so, yeah. I would say so. I think they're quite... I'm not sure that I wouldn't call them effortless. Absolutely not.
No, because they're like designer clad, and they're really... The fashion on it is, like, incredible. We were talking about Balenciaga. I mean, they're all in Balenciaga Crocs with heels, or they're in Balenciaga slides. if they're making so much of an effort, it makes me think of things like the Kardashians or reality TV, in the fact that we're kind of seeing all the work that goes into this persona. Are they a comment on class? Are they a comment on kind of taste?
I think so, yeah. And I think all this, you know, when these markers become visible, when it's clear that, you know, if you do your lip liner slightly outside of the lip, or you just have a little bit too much cake makeup, and or it's just, you know, all of these markers that's supposed to be sort of invisibly seamless and smooth starts to really get pressed to the surface, and you get kind of crack up and becomes very sort of materialized in that sense. It starts to really tell a story about, class and gender identity and all these sort of nuanced markers are really, telling in that sense. And I think in my work, what I'm trying to do is to really look for, these different, all these details, let's say. I think I'm just really obsessed with all these small details that are giving all of these things away, in a sense.
Talking of those little indicators of small details, I feel like if you think about the clothing that Russell mentioned, for example, like the pencil skirt, like as an idea, I was really taken by all of these kind of references you have, such as that, in terms of like the alteration of the body or the transformation of the body to become like appealing to other people, perhaps, or to empower the individual to feel strong, or even like this idea of like plastic surgery or like tummy tucks, which I know has also been a reference. Can you speak a bit about that idea, like the way that we as humans want to transform our bodies? Because also I think it happens in the animal world as well, actually, but not in that literal way of having operations, but in terms of like plumage in birds and the way that you might look like a really dull bird and then suddenly you're bright colors, or, you know, there's all these ways of communicating through the form of the body.
I think so in my latest works, for example, I have a show that's up now in the Kunsthalle Mannheim, and it's entitled Premium Economy, and there's a number of sculptures that sort of perform some sort of functionality in one way or another, but it's sort of questionable what this is actually for. I guess I'm sort of developing a formal language of trying to, guide the performers into position, and that way making, let's say, sort of a sculptural script for the performers. And what they're doing is really to sort of fit their bodies into this kind of seemingly functional forms, but in a way they really have to sort of adjust. I think that their bodies in a way becomes merge together with these objects eventually. And I think this has sort of been a theme in my practice from the very start, that I started making a performance piece back in 2009 that was entitled Girlfriend Experience. And it was really about this idea of actively trying to objectify oneself and turning oneself into, let's say, a product, or maybe something user-friendly, let's say, being at service in sort of seemingly offering a kind of a commercial service while actually manipulating the viewer or whoever is going to receive this service into some sort of action that might be, I don't know, it's at the end of the day quite manipulative, but helpful somehow. I don't know how to describe it, but I think this idea of sort of shaping the body into something that feels closer to an object, and but also sort of doing so in as a sort of behavioral plane simultaneously is something that I've been sort of interested in for quite some time.
But your work is rooted in sculpture, but fundamentally, for me, everything is performance-based. If we're seeing the static sculptures, they're performing for us. We were just talking about premium economy, and I love that title, and another title, Continental Breakfast, that has all these sort of furniture pieces that you've created that then get activated by a performer or a member of the public, if they're allowed to clamber in, and they have these armrests and footrests and like knee joints, and you get in and it's like a balancing act. Again, it's figurative, and even without the performer present, these are figurative objects because you can see the shape that a human body would make. When did you realize that the figure was, you know, these female figures, these hyper kind of feminine figures, were the device, were how you were going to tell your stories?
I mean, I think what happened, I mean, it sort of happened gradually, starting from performance and making, reacting to different situations and really understanding performativity as sort of an act that has been rehearsed so many times that we are becoming what we're acting, let's say, and then in a way trying to tweak, look at that as a look at performativity as sort of a daily life script that I was sort of trying to tweak in different manners. Somewhere along the way when working with performers, I wanted to sort of started to sort of translate my role as a performer into something that was outside of myself. So that's how I came about sculpture. I mean, I did sculptures previously, but use them more as sort of props for different video performances that I did. But the figurative sculptures really came out of the same place as my performer pieces were coming from. Yeah.
And the earlier works, the face was very visible, but these later works, they're faceless, and we're seeing this long... they look quite expensive wigs that are covering up the features. Why is that important that they're faceless for you now? And what does that give you?
I think just as a, you know, because I did a couple of, as you mentioned, some works in the early figurative sculptures that had a face visible. And something happens for me as a viewer, you constantly want to go, you want to see the face, you want to understand who you're looking at, and you probably want to see the eyes as well. And for me, that was a bit, because the type of faces that I was interested in was also very sort of, had a lot of work done, let's say. Like, I would want them to be, I've always been interested in the sort of some sort of generic beauty standards, let's say. And I guess the idea of being some sort of performed genuinity and the idea, like, so I guess the idea of what we think of as authentic, let's say. And many of us wants to connect that, the identity to a face. But in when working with sculpture, in my opinion, it sort of dies a little bit there. Like I'm confronted with this work, and I see this face, and that's it, you know. But if there's like some wild hair in front of the face, then you never, there are a lot of, you have to sort of fill out the blanks yourself as a viewer. And I think the character becomes much more sort of present and in a way alive in the space if you don't.
They feel quite.
Yeah.
Yeah. It feels quite intimidating, weirdly. It feels like there's sort of, for me, they're tinged slightly with violence at a point that they could turn around and slap you and be like, stop looking at me. Even though they want it, it's like, it's this really fine balance. But I would love to talk about, like, when you come to see your sculptures, the work that goes into it, and I'm trying to imagine how big your studio is, and if you have a fabrication workshop, and how big your team is, because these things are so intricate and beautifully rendered. What is the sort of work that goes into each sculpture, and what is the materiality? Because they blow my mind.
Well, I really come from a pretty classical sculptural, you know, approach. So I would start with a pose that I'm curious about at the moment. And then in the very beginning, I did a lot of posing myself and asked my friend or partner to just take a lot of pictures, and then, but now.
So you're very flexible then, right? You're incredibly flexible, because some of these angles are insane.
Exactly. So the very flexible ones, I had to quickly go over to. I have a friend who's a stunt, Helga Wretman. She's doing stunt. She's kind of tiny, really flexible person. And I would ask her to do all these impossible poses and photograph her in all angles, basically scan her from every possible angle, and print out all of these pictures on the walls in my studio, and then start making an armature out of metal, and then build with clay on top of this.
No way, yeah, they're clay.
Yeah, yeah. So first clay, and then it's casted. So yeah. So I would sculpt in clay and then cast in fiberglass and aqua resin.
Wow. Does the clay get lost in the process?
Yeah.
You know, when you do the, it gets lost. So that's kind of magic, isn't it?
Well, so you basically take the clay, original, let's say, is long gone. So I would take these forms, and once I have this solid sculpture in fiberglass, I would start the process of the surface that would be, it's very, I guess, comparable to a painting, or, you know, I don't necessarily plan that much. I just really put things on and try things until I respond to it myself, and I guess that's when.
Are you constantly like archiving and acquiring fashionable pieces, or like you were saying, you'd go past and it'd be like a counterfeit handbag or a counterfeit coat? Or I think you were saying, I read an article that you only wear fake Balenciagas yourself because you feel like it's better than actually spending €800 on a pair of Balenciagas. There's something about like the fact that you'd feel like an idiot if you actually spent that money, so you're fine wearing the fake stuff. But you have like a whole wardrobe or a closet for these women that you can sort of dress them like a stylist, it feels like, in some capacity.
I mean, I would, so a lot of material that I'm using is also actually not even fabrics. Like I would use vinyl flooring and some rattan pieces, or, you know, like I would, because I think there's been sort of a long period when I also sort of was interested in seeing how these figures could again melt into some sort of imaginary interior, and thinking of sort of generic hotel rooms with these really sort of veneers that were all these sort of aspirational materials that sort of wants to look like, I don't know, whatever material it's referring to, but it has starting to, you know, it's sort of a copy of a copy. So it's at one point, it's questionable what it is we're looking at, even. Like, it's sort of a, mutant of marble, let's say. So, and I think that's the type of material that I'm curious about, like this sort of, I guess, simulated ideas of interiors that are then later applied onto these figures.
There's also this kind of like uselessness of the design sometimes, you know, like you're in a hotel room and you've got all these things and it seems like the room's being really helpful to you because you've got all these ledges and all these tables and a writing desk and, you know, all this stuff. And then you're like, A, I can't turn the lights on. B, I don't need a little ledge. You know what I mean? Like, the whole thing is just kind of impractical, but it kind of looks like they're trying to be so helpful. And it's also kind of ugly. And it got me onto thinking about the way that I first felt about your work was this idea of municipal space. So like almost like town planning or like public space. And in the UK, Carl Friedman and I work with him at the gallery, like we often go to like around different towns and to go and see different museums and all those kind of things. You know, you travel following your artist, and we always have a joke, like, it's the municipal space, because it's like, you know, they've made a fake park that has like concrete floor and like one tree, and it's like really grim, and it always feels like it's trying to be helpful, but it actually is just totally impractical and useless. But when I saw your work, I just thought the attention to reference is so interesting, because you have like, I don't know, handlebars, or like, I don't know, there's all these little things that are really subtle references to kind of the contemporary like desperation for futuristic kind of healing through like science fiction, but it's actually really badly made or something. Or even when you're in an airport and you're walking through and then you see all those machines massaging people and you're kind of like, do I really want a massage from like a computer? You know what I mean? Like, is that really defeating the point of it? Or for me, I don't know, it just makes me laugh. Is municipal space something that directly informs the work?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely resonate with everything that you just said. Like, it's like, I think this whole idea of making something feel like it's sort of like it sometimes, I think, a hotel room or the park that you just described, it's almost like this sort of simulated idea of what we are supposed to appreciate, I guess, but yeah. It's just sort of mediocre at the end of the day, you know. And it's I guess this is also why I'm curious about this, the sort of hyper generic aesthetics, because it's also when something is supposed to be for everybody, it's questionable. Who is it actually for? Like, who wants yeah. this? You know what I mean? It's like,
who asked for it?
Yeah. And
did we just want some trees?
Exactly.
You know what I mean? It's some real trees with real soil.
And it's also this feeling of sort of deep fake. It's yes. been faked so many times over and over again. At one point, I guess it's sort of, I don't know, this idea of staging something that is supposed to make us feel good, or it's supposed to be, I guess, an authentic experience. But then this idea of whatever authentic is becomes just such a fetish, fetishized thought to begin with, and we just sort of further, yeah. It's so I think a lot of these exactly this is what I'm really interested in my practice. But then how is that manifested in choice of materials, and like what type of I think I'm just curious to combine different markers and materials to sort of trigger that maximize that feeling of, I guess, I don't know if it's whatever, if we call it uselessness or yeah, it's sort of looking fake, but being expensive, but it looks fake, or you know, like all of this.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah.
I think it's basically we're all like adhering to the most dominant culture when it comes to, you know, municipal design and fashion and what we're perceived that's meant to be. And what you do is you kind of distort those traditions and you play with that. And do you consider an audience coming into your work? Because I found it really fascinating when I was walking around the Perimeter Gallery recently that everybody's so quiet. And this work is so raucous and kind of sexy and out there, but yet there's this real studious like silence around it. Like you don't want to disturb them. It's quite a creepy energy at times. Do you consider an audience and how they feel about you? Because I'm sure over the years you've had various people saying that it's kind of bondage or sadomasochism, or is it about control, or is it, you know, we were saying about, have they got agency? Haven't they got agency? How much of the audience do you have in your mind's eye when you're creating your work?
I mean, I always consider myself as the audience. Making work in my studio, I'm sort of the first-hand audience, and whatever I respond to, that's what sort of guides me further on into the practice. But it's, you know, predicting. I guess when I start, so taking it back again to where, how I started making my performance pieces, I purposefully wanted to bring in you know, mix context for how what behavior is sort of appropriate here but not there, and so forth. And I had this one piece in that was called Body Stretch, and wait, what was it now? We need to edit this because I don't remember the name. It was like mind, body, mind, stretch, and submission. And I was invited for a Christmas lunch that was hosted by the top galleries in Stockholm back in 2013, I think. And they had gathered all their collectors and they wanted me to sort of show up as a sort of a host, hostesses, because my girlfriend experience, my previous performance was sort of similar as a hostess. But when I got this invitation, I thought it could be interesting to do something more out of that. So I was there together with two other girls that I invited to perform with me. And we were enacting sort of these personnel, or like this event service personnel, that would refill people's glasses. But then thinking if we would have been the hostess, then we should have also been invited for, I guess, a glass or something to drink. So we asked, after we refilled, we said, can we please, would you mind inviting us back for something to drink? And so we handed over the bottle of champagne to the viewers, and they would, or to the audience, and then we would kneel down and sort of open our mouths, look them straight into the eyes while they were pouring champagne into our mouths. So what happened was really that there was this fancy collector dinner turned into some sort of really kinky, dom and slave scenario where
obsessed.
So good.
How many performers were there?
It was just me and two other performers. And
with the champagne go everywhere,
even better,
was you like
though,
covered?
That's even more
you,
focused.
Yeah,
it's just like,
that's amazing.
It's a bit terrifying. I mean, I can imagine these collectors being like, "Oh God, okay, yes, I will do this." And I bet it was going all over your clothes, and that was something obviously you embraced.
It would really just sort of drip down. So it would have this. It would be a very sort of straightforward cum shot, like I guess Bukkake.
Yeah.
You know, image.
Bukkake. Yeah. Yes, yes. We need a Bukkake champagne party somewhere else. We need to bring this back. This is incredible. This is completely up my street.
But yes, I think what happened there was really that we did everything right, so to speak. Like, we played along with the sort of rule book of how this sort of service personnel behaves. And then also, from my perspective, I was an artist that just graduated at the time from art school. And, you know, there's this one unwritten rule that you never really approach a gallery yourself. Like, you have to be, you know, picked. And that sort of passive role for me was very kind of difficult and frustrating in many ways. So, and there was obviously this sort of power dynamic between artists and collector at the time. So for me, to sort of just bringing this unspoken, I guess, power dynamics to the very forefront of the situation and make that, let's say, visible, and becoming this sort of power bottom, let's say, at the time, and or being on top from the bottom, let's say, or really trying. Yeah, and in that sense also, I guess, being there at service, but it's questionable who asked for this, like, and in a way also dominating the situation while helping, you know what I mean? And
but also entertaining them at the same time, because they're all watching you. So you are the performance. It's a really complicated structure. I love it.
They became obviously part of it as well.
Yeah.
And in this specific case, I really was sort of intrigued by how one could sort of tweak and flip different social events, you know. And there's the crowd that's there, that's given.
Wow,
you have,
I loved it.
That you have this for free already. And then also what I thought was beautiful about it was that everybody who attend a dinner like this, they're already sort of performing. They're performing their best self, so they're a little bit self-centered already, and which means that they might not fully pay attention to what they're actually participating in, which was they might be a bit too distracted to see what was actually happening.
They're all,
but also self-conscious because they're being watched by their peers,
yeah,
and the ones that the other collectors or the
and
other patrons or the gallery director. So there's a sense of that
social
too.
Contracts, aren't they? And you're breaking those social contracts.
Breaking the social veneer.
Did they love it? I mean, what was the response? Were they absolutely embracing it? Did it just kick off?
They do. They were all a bit I guess intimidated, but also excited somehow. But also, I think they found it a bit scary too. I heard many, because we filmed the whole thing. I can send you the link.
Yes, please.
And they were like, "Oh, this is scary," or somebody said it. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's intimidating and it's uncomfortable.
That's really good, because that is also something I wanted to talk to you about, which is this undercurrent of, it's not sinister, but it's kind of like almost like a classic thriller movie. And often when I look at your work, I have a soundtrack in my head and it's always something from the 70s or 80s or something like that. And there's some kind of like synth playing, but like early synth, and also a bit of an American horror kind of gruesome like undercurrent. And it's quite subtle, but I feel like it's throbbing and it's kind of like there, and there's this threat, like whether it be the dentist chair, you know, you have like subtle references that I think would recall something in the viewer's brain. Can you speak a bit about that idea of horror or threat?
I'm not sure. I mean, for me, I guess going back to the idea of the social contract, and that we have these sort of unspoken agreements of how we behave, you know, and I guess that's where I find BDSM something very interesting, because there this contract is very spelled out and it's sort of, you know, black and white, like this is what we agree, this is our actual agreement. So for me, translating those type of social contracts into sort of sculptural works start to become in a way like, I guess, like a sculptural social agreement or something. I try to spell it out in a certain sense, and there is the level of, I guess, sorting out what different sort of power structures and relations to how we relate to our own bodies, but also in relation to these objects, and how the public view is sort of part of that, and maybe even propelled by social media and other sort of technologies that makes this interaction even more, I guess, on view or on display. So there's this voyeuristic factor to it as well.
Yeah, the permission to stare, keep going back to that. But what is a night out with Anna like? Are you a pervert? Do you end up getting into situations? Are you playing out fantasies through this work, or is this something that you really are, is kind of an authentic kind of lifestyle for you?
I mean, I have to say, because I come from, so I don't want to live on like old merits, or how do you might call it, but I used to be pretty wild party, like I loved, you know, I was a pretty wild party girl, I suppose. But like, I haven't been drinking alcohol now since over 4 years or something like that. So I'm just sort of, I kind of left that behind, in the sense that I'm not that person anymore, let's say. I guess I'm not the most fun person. I mean, I still go out a lot. Like but I just don't drink. I just don't get wasted. So I'm not that. Let's say, I'm just pretty decent, actually. Disappointing, boring. Yeah.
But people come into this work, which just would have, you know, they would just create a narrative for the artist, which I guess is something that you I hope, embrace and enjoy the what people would think you're like. Because before you came on today, there's not many, you know, our audience can't see you, but there's not many things online of what you look like, you know. And in some ways I was thinking, are you in the work? Because you've also made this film, which has been a commission, co-commission with the Perimeter Gallery, yourself, and another space.
You'll Black have to remind Cube. Me who that other
Right, and Black Cube. And this is the first time you've done that. And there's the performers in that with the pencil skirts and the kind of gel back hair. And then there's this sort of matriarch who's guiding you round at one point, sort of introducing you to these torture objects they look like to begin with. And I assumed if that was you, maybe at some point, but that isn't you either. You don't appear in any of your performances.
No, this performance that I did back in at the Christmas dinner with the collectors, it was quite an intense experience and I loved it, but I also felt afterwards that I wanted to sort of move. I wanted to either start directing, or I wanted to move this character, instead of having me performing this role, I would transfer this energy to a sculptural work instead. So I really enjoy being able to sort of watch what's happening, and if I'm in the picture myself, I'm just not, you know, able to do that in the same way.
I sort of see you as a conductor for some reason. I keep bringing music back to it, but I sort of see you as this great mastermind, and that it's all like, you know, your hands are above it all somehow.
Yes, I hear Bjork going through it as well, like the musicality of that, and the stuff that goes really fantastical when you see the music videos and the costumes and the kind of hyper realism that she's playing with. I feel like that there's a real energy with your work and her work.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's very fantastic. I love her. I think, although I have to say, what I think where I relate to or where I come from is maybe not necessarily that sort of drama. It's not that much drama or theater, let's say. More, I'm trying to stay with what we recognized as, you know, something very realistic. But within this realism, there is a lot of layers of performativity, and that's kind of where my interest is.
You know, she almost came out of the punk era as well, because I think her performativity has gone almost like to opera or something, but it is a very hyper real digital space as well. But for me, it was more like Planning to Rock or like The Knife, or where it's a similar universe kind of as Bjork, but it's sort of a bit more specific. Or Tori Rones as well, the performance artist from Norway. I love her work as well.
I think you've described it as a perverted performative version of reality, the way I experience it, is just so amazing. And also you've said, it, instead of representing something, I want to trigger something so that it becomes real in a way. Mm. It's always, you know, you're pushing it somewhere where it feels like out of our realm. And then before you know it, it becomes our reality because we're coexisting
next
to it.
And it's an invitation. It's like an invitation the viewer to interact.
You've got to be brave around the work. Your work commands a certain bravery from the audience member to engage with it. Because, you know, there's titles like Pussy Padding or Rosebud, and there's piercings that go all the way along like genitalia at different moments. And, you know, it makes you uncomfortable to be observing this artwork where someone else is observing you. You know that notion when you're looking at quite artwork that's quite out there, and you know that other people are watching your reaction, and there's definitely that feeling around your work, which I love, I embrace, and I'm always watching audience members around, you know, your work and how audience members behave in front of like the paintings of Lisa Yuskavage, for example, you know, or even Tracy Emin. It's like the way that people are allowing themselves to behave around it is really as fascinating as the work itself.
Yeah, I think it's really also, I guess what I'm curious about is to how far can, how I guess, how do you know, but if it would be just pure, straight up nudity, or if you would just put like a, you know, some, I don't know, actual genitalia in somebody's face, you would have this really sort of, I guess, reaction that is the, I don't know. I think what I'm curious about is really what happens when you sort of do all that, but in a cute way, or like, I mean, for me, I'm being curious about this, how everything that is sort of commercially viable or has a level of cuteness to it, and how grown-ups are sort of in a sense becoming cuter and cuter, and in a way also more and more like that is sort of in this infantilization of adults that I'm sort of also find kind of perverse in a really sort of intriguing way. So and I think, I guess, yeah, this sort of in your face experience, I sort of still wanna keep it. How do you say? I still want this to be in within the limits of what one consider, normal. Let's say normal. Yeah, normal for me is already really weird. You know, it's completely twisted. But
I mean, for some people coming to the work, they'd be like completely unshocked. They're like, well, this is, I know these people. I've got that outfit. You know, there must be people that come to that and be like, oh, great, I'm seen. I do exist. There I am. That must be really fascinating.
There is something subversive, though, about it, like, for sure. I think at its core. And I love that about it. There's a kind of, like, strength in that subversive.
Yeah, totally. What are the rules you set for yourself when it comes to, like, your art practice? Do you not work on a certain day? Do you only create work when you're building towards exhibitions? You know, for other artists listening, what is your studio practice and what are the rules that you've set?
I mean, I make sure to have one day a week where I'm not working. I didn't have that before for a really long time, but then since I moved to Germany, you know, everything is closed here on Sundays. I don't know. So, but that's just that for me, that was a bit strange, and I never had these rules before. I could work any time of the day and night, all days of the week, you know. But I think it's kind of healthy, and it feels good to have one day a week when it happens to be a Sunday now, where I'm just not working, and it's good for everything, for the work and for me and for everyone. I think I generally need some sort of deadline to get anything done. And so for me, a deadline is really sort of a tool, actually, to just push things forward. It needs to have a time frame for a project is really important. Otherwise, everything gets very random at one point.
How's it felt doing the show at the Perimeter, where you've got 10 sculptures that you've made over a period of 7 years? Because as a contemporary artist, often you're just constantly moving on to the next thing, moving forward, pushing forward, trying to not think about the immediate past. Has it been useful to, like, look back and kind of see it all together as a body of work?
Yeah, very much so. And I'm so happy to also work with Alex at the Perimeter. They're just lovely people to work with, and the space is absolutely fantastic. So it was very satisfying for me to see all these works that marks really like a chapter in my practice, presented in a space that has all this sort of domestic qualities, but then again, being very much a gallery space, as well. So I think
an elevated.
Yeah.
It's a very elevated space, isn't it? Like aesthetically beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah. And when you see it, there's carpeted, like it's carpeted in certain rooms. It makes such a difference to, you know, your experience of receiving art when you're in this sort of hyper comfortable situation, which you wouldn't normally experience in a gallery context.
God, talking of carpets, I love that work where you've got the sculpture and it's like clawing the carpet.
Clawing across the carpet.
That is one of the most sensory fucked up works ever. I love it. That, like, you have my heart in this work. It's
so you, Rob. That's what
it's
you do all the time.
No,
you throw Rob on
like,
some carpet.
It just makes you
flooring.
Feel so strange, as like when you're looking at it,
yeah,
because
it
feels so intimate and like ecstatic and all of these things.
But it's funny as well.
It's funny as well. Exactly,
you know,
yeah.
Humor plays such an important role in all of your practice. And I think in some capacity, you can sort of neglect to include that in your you know, the way you're receiving the work. And actually, it's so important, you know. And talking to you now, you're obviously a very funny person and can make light of, you know, sex, which is uncomfortable for many people, and they can't.
I mean, I think this is also sometimes I get, as you mentioned, that the people that the audience is could be sometimes very quiet around my work. It's also for me a bit surprising, I gotta say, because I do think that I definitely come from, I mean, I guess humor in general has to have sort of a serious, or there has to be something quite disturbing to it for it to actually work. I think thinking of comedy or also really like really great comedians, they can sort of hit the spot on like a lot of levels at the same time. So it becomes sort of the complexity of a really that could make you laugh. Sometimes you don't even know why you're laughing, kind of. And I think that is the quality that art can have too. Like, you don't necessarily have to bring an answer to the table. You can actually open up for more questions, or it can be. I think also. In my case, I'm really sort of attracted to certain topics that are also sort of deeply problematic at the same time, and letting that those conflicting sort of feelings towards something exist simultaneously is. Yeah, I think it's interesting when a work can sort of have the ability to be many things at the same time.
Yes, multi-nuanced, all of your practices, totally. And I think as artists, you have to be people that are engaging with problematic ideas to work them out into art. That's what artists do.
I always thought the word punchline was really a great word as well, because it is like a punch almost. It's like the final moment that you kind of reveal the joke in a way. But there's something quite profound about it,
yeah.
And political. And actually, at its core, I think a lot of comedy can be to do with liberation as well, as can art, you know, and as can some of the greatest artists. I think there's something about your work that kind of offers a sense of liberation for people to unlock something, or their own potential, or their weird psyches, like the things they're trying to hide from themselves.
Or just the fact that they're a slut.
Before we go on to our final questions, how do you feel about the digital realm? Because you mentioned social media earlier and the impact it can have. I know you've had a video before that went viral from a Meredith Rosen performance. So you've already had an experience.
That
of
was
like
Continental
how,
Breakfast, wasn't it?
Yeah, Continental Breakfast, yeah. How a performance can somehow go into a whole other audience, like through the internet. Are you interested in AI? Are you kind of interested in making films that just exist in the internet, or?
I would come from, I mean, I did this one, there's this one work on view in at the Parameter in Home Records that's titled Journey of Self-Discovery, which is a figure that sort of take a selfie of her own behind, let's say. And in this work was, I've made that 2016. I think what I've, you know, what I was interested in is sort of this feedback loop of, I guess, reward systems of, you know, you respond to imagery that you also sort of bring out back into the in this loophole of interaction that I think social media can be sometimes, and also this idea of that we're, I guess it's also really sort of this rewarding, you know, how we sort of get rewarded up to for certain behaviors, and in a way I'm curious how much, you know, that algorithm really sort of goes ingrained in our behavior, and how certain type of, I guess, mimetic behavior is developed, and I guess I'm also interested in this idea of, I mean, and this was even back in 2009 when I did this performance girlfriend experience, but it was so much about trying to sort of actively behave as a product. How what is that? And just being this sort of you know, objectify oneself in the sense that you could get this sort of very self-aware performed genuinity. And for me, that I am curious about this sort of generic behaviors that are altered, personal or authentic, but it feels to me that we are fabricating or pushing this idea of what this authentic authentic behavior actually is, you know, and why are we even doing that? Like it's like so many of these questions are sort of interesting for me, and I think
it's modification of behavior, isn't it? And in a way, it's similar to the pencil skirt, or it's similar to, I think it's like the human condition and the way our brains work in the internet. It's just become really likely.
Well, it's almost like the fake thing is almost more authentic than the actual real thing. Do you know what I mean? That's right. What it's sort of gone to. And I think that is, you know, what your practice is. And that's just fucking great. I love talking to you. We're going to go into a ton of questions now. If you could do an art heist, you could steal any work of art in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
Oh, what would it be and why? Okay, I would probably want to have... I would snatch the Mona Lisa.
Do you ever look at other... like sculptors that deal with hyperrealism? Like I've really considered Rom Newark into some capacity when I think of your work, and the fact that these are hyperreal. He plays around with scale, but it's this, again, it's quite an uncomfortable situation when you're encountering his sculpture.
Because Robert Gober,
for example. Yes, you know, there's this whole thing. Do you ever think of these yourself in the lineage of these artists that are really playing with the hyperreal?
I don't. Actually, I have to say that I don't think I'm relating that much to hyper-realist artists. I mean, I would say, I mean, back in the days, I was an intern for Ryan Tricard and Lisa Fitch, for example.
Yes.
And they have been, I mean, their art really blew my mind. Yes. And they're still... they still do, you know. It's like, so I think for me, that the type of hyper that I would be interested in, like, goes more in their direction than this sort of very sort of what you would think of as hyper realist, sort of very sort of crafted. I don't know. It's very technical, usually, I think.
And did you ever get involved in any of their films? They're like 24-hour films that they did.
No, I was there at the time when there was no. They didn't shoot anything when I was there, unfortunately. Okay. But no.
Wild. Well, that must
they're
be
wilder
so cool.
and more experimental for sure.
So cool.
The other question we ask every guest is, "What is your favorite color?"
Okay, I would say perhaps sort of lavender, light blue lavender.
And why? What is that?
I have no idea. Just respond to it. Soft. It's soft. Yeah.
Do you wear that color? Do you ever like have that around you?
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah. I don't. Did you think it's like I don't really have a favorite color? Like I would say, like right now, I'm very much have like all this sort of. Tones. I'm very much into like different sort of gray tones, but I've been very sort of also sort of trying to. I've been working a lot with different type of so-called nude the tones that are also just sort of artificial idea of skin tones. Let's say, but, yeah.
Like Skims, like the Kardashian Skims.
Yeah, for sure.
There's also loads of controversy around all of that, you know, because of different people's skin colours and
for sure.
how inaccurate it all is. And how, you know, the same with the history of photography. There's so many kind of like racist structures within all of that. It's gross. But I thought you were going to say steel grey or something, like some kind of cool metal colour.
a dystopian colour. What is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your art?
I don't know. Maybe somebody told me. Actually, I think somebody actually told me once, because I used to be so stressed out, like in the sense that I was really not healthy. And this had to do with deadlines. And then somebody said, well, use your deadline is really the best tool you could use to get something instead of feeling that you're being crushed under the pressure. You could actually use it as a to your advantage. It's a tool to get anywhere, you know, and that helped a lot. It really did.
To reduce anxiety, yeah.
That's gonna be great advice for someone listening for anybody listening who's on deadlines, to actually see it as a positive. Movement as an energy of momentum,
well,
rather
it's almost
than
like a gift you're being
rather
given,
than fatigue or paralyzed. Yeah, it is a deadline is a privilege.
Yeah. It's great.
Yeah, totally.
We love deadlines.
We love deadlines. We love you. We love privileges. So thank
before
you
we go,
so much.
Can you tell us in the studio? Do you listen to music, or do you have any snacks to like keep you going? What's your fuel?
Yes, I definitely listen to music. I'm happy that people around me are also into listening to things on repeat, because I do that a lot.
The same song. On repeat,
yeah,
I
would have, or like it would be maybe an hour mix that would go on repeat for a whole project.
What sort of genre of music?
I mean, there was one, I had a really long period with Frill. He's like, I guess, techno, I love everything. I think techno is really good for studio work, because it's sort of, when it's not too much, it's good when it's not too much lyrics. It's just sort of puts you in this work high
mood.
Yeah.
Well, you're in Berlin, so I think techno is something that they're renowned for. I don't think you're going to have a lack of being able to access techno in Berlin. Just get down to the
Berghain.
What's the Berghain exactly, which
Panorama.
I've been turned away from twice and never been to, but one
I
day
have been
I will
there
go there.
Twice,
I know,
you.
Show off. This has been heaven, Anna Udenberg. Thank you so much for coming on. It's such a privilege to talk to you. So the exhibition Home Wreckers is at the Perimeter Gallery in Clerkenwell in London. That is on until when, Rob?
22nd of December. So you still have a week to go and see it before Christmas and make it your Christmas gift, going and seeing Anna's work.
There's posters there that you can get that are signed, which are beautiful. And also you have a big exhibition at the Kunsthalle, which we didn't really talk about, the Kunsthalle Mannheim.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's on into next year?
Exactly, until I think late April next year.
Great, amazing. And you're on social media? You're on Instagram?
Yeah, I am.
And your name?
My name is Filet Mignon Thong.
So it's Filet Mignon Thong.
Thong, exactly.
Which we will link to. But what is that? Just quickly, people are going to be like, why? What is that? So like a filet wearing a thong.
You know, I started this Instagram account, didn't have any followers, and I thought, that was, why not? It's a great name. And now I can't really get rid of it, or I don't want to get rid of it.
Everybody wants that. Everybody wants that handle. Everybody's after that handle. Never, you could, yeah. Filet Mignon Thong.
That's how you identify. We respect that. And you can go to theperimeter.co.uk to get details of the show, and there on Instagram as well, at The Perimeter London. And who's your gallery? Do you have a gallery?
Yeah, so I work with Kraupa Tuskenit Seidler here in Berlin.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
Meredith Rosen Gallery in New York.
So we will link to both of those as well. And thank you to them for allowing us to chat to the legend that is Anna Udberg.
She's also great on social media.
Yeah.
I love Meredith. So we will be back very soon.
Thanks,
thank
Anna.
You for listening, and let's go wreck some homes. Okay,
bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.